All right, here we go. Another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. This is Christian Horn, and I'm here with my part-time fanboys, Ian Scheller and Mark Altman. How's everybody doing?
It's going. It's going.
So what are we going to talk about this week? I know that you guys have some subjects that you wanted to discuss. And I think we are going to start off with Ian because he was gone last week, right?
I was gone, but I'm back.
What were you doing?
I hit New York for a couple parties and a couple business meetings.
Nice.
And it was great. Good trip. Very quick. The weather was good. It was not a holiday weekend in New York. So, nice. Yeah, it was really cool. Good to see family and friends, but good to be back.
Good for you. I love New York. I miss it so much.
When it's on when it's Saturday night there, it's not fun. obviously we were there for some of it, but once it calmed down, like Sunday night was just great. All the tourists left. But yeah, good to be back. I did, out of the corner of my eye, I spotted some comic book stores I used to hit. Although I did not go in, I held off just because the schedule was so packed. But, actually one of the things I wanted to talk about, or just start to talk about, and hopefully we can carry this on, if it proves interesting, was ebook publishing.
Which is the death of the comic book shop, right?
It could be. And I've been working on a book of small comic strips, and the debates come up in my head is, you know, which way to go as far as paper publishing and ebook publishing. So I just dove into the popular formats and kind of saw what was out there. There is a lot of good documentation on the web. So this would really be for someone who's interested in publishing their own work, whether it be comics or, fiction, nonfiction, or just someone who's interested in general about how this all works. There's a lot of formats out there. Yeah. It's not like, you know, the nice thing about music is that, you know, we just pretty much have MP3s and, you know, people share those. But with e-publishing, everyone's got their own flavor, and hopefully next week we could even get into the specific comic book publishers now that are online pushing their own readers and pushing their own format. So I'm just going to go over real briefly the top three, which would be the Apple iBooks author publishing, the Amazon Kindle, and the Nook. So first of all, just to start with Apple, since I guess they're the biggest now. I remember
those
days.
Are they the biggest compared to Amazon? I mean, are they? Did they overtake Amazon?
I guess just company wise, you know, they're the big ones. But
and do you have an iPad? Do you?
No, I have none of that.
Me neither.
Mark, do you have any i stuff?
I don't. And this is actually just briefly. I know that some people have spoken about the fact that. That the comics moving into this kind of digital realm changes the experience. And I mean, when they say changes the experience, it's like, well, what's the experience of kind of looking at it on one of these newer formats versus the old kind of flipping the page type thing in a traditional comic?
Right. I think there is a big difference. I mean, you're not going to get the smell of the paper, which to me is actually, that's actually a big deal. I love paper. I mean, hopefully this won't change it huge. I mean, speaking of which, Apple did release a comic book only bookstore within the bookstore. So,
oh, really?
Yes. So real quick, I'm not going to really get into the end user agreement stuff. This is just an overview of if you would get into publishing on these formats. After you've completed, say that we're doing artwork. After you complete your artwork, you have to have it somewhere. If you're doing artwork, you know, it could be in PSDs, it could be high quality JPEGs, it could be Illustrator files. That's got to get run through this, you know, Apple specific software called iBooks Author, which is free if you register, you know, with their app store. So you got to fill in your account. I think you give them your credit card information, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can download iBooks Author.
Uh-huh.
For for free. That program is going to let you take your content and run it through their software and publish it for iPad. When I work on website stuff, I use an iPhone emulator, which is part of iOS. I'm thinking that this iBooks Author is pretty much the same emulator, except it's going to show you what it looks like on an iPad. Now, that's just for iPad.
Yeah.
So to jump briefly into the other formats, if you're on Amazon Kindle, it's a different story. So they have a Kindle publishing program called KDP Select. And from what I hear from professional authors, this is the way to go.
Really?
And these are guys that write fiction and nonfiction. A lot of people have been going this route. It's a 70% royalty, meaning if we published, we would keep 70%. Amazon takes 30.
Really? Because I know that Apple has been getting a lot of criticism, because what do they get? They get a pretty big chunk, don't they?
I think it's similar. I actually didn't get into that, and that's something I could totally get into next week if we think it's worth it. The yeah. thing when you jump into Kindle, though, it's a different process. So mm-hmm. you're going to take your content and you're going to run it through a different piece of software, which is Kindle and Amazon's thing, and then you're going to get the final product. Now, yeah. again, it just seems kind of interesting, you know, because you're going to be doing a lot of repetition kind of work, and no one really knows. I can't even speak on. I haven't even heard of what the differences or not differences are between the formats. You know, for another web reference, you guys know. You know, you jump in between browsers and desktop platforms. Sometimes you have like formatting issues, and especially if you're doing something like comics, which is sequential, I could see that there's definitely going to be some troubleshooting. The third format, which is for Nook, which is Barnes & Noble's reader. They've tagged onto the EPUB format, and the EPUB format, from what I could see here, is really based on almost a HTML, XHTML type build. Mm-hmm. So you're actually building your content in a way that's very similar to building a web page. And then that is compiled and published into the EPUB format. Now, keep in mind, from the Apple platform to the Amazon Kindle platform to the Nook platform, you're doing three different ways of compiling your media. And I would hope or think that you've got to then do three different tests on all those platforms. And right now, that would be probably another conversation. So
that,
I mean,
just sounds like
what have you guys heard
pain
as
in
far
the ass.
As
that sounds What's like that? A huge pain in the ass. It's like, I mean, you yeah. know just as well as I do, you guys know how hard it is just to put the damn thing together.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then it's like, you got to run it through three different, I mean, with the EPUB format, do you have to know code? It sounds like you need to know code. Do you need coding
yeah.
knowledge?
Just looking at the beginnings of this EPUB, there's something called an EPUB archive.
Yeah.
So there's a great, maybe we could post these links to part-time fanboy with the podcast that might help some people, but
yeah.
just looking at the directory file layout for a simple EPUB archive, and I'm reading this right off of a site called IBM.com. They have a MIME type followed by a meta container, which is an XML file. And a lot of people might be familiar with XML because that's what RSS feeds have been published under. Yeah. And RSS feeds, of course, let people know if there's a new podcast or new content refreshing on a website. Within the EPUB file below the XML file, you have .html files, you have CSS files, and the images here, at least in this example, are PNG files. So you're looking at a very web-oriented type of build here for the EPUB.
That sounds very complicated. I mean, I understand a decent amount of web stuff, but I'm sure your average person is sitting there thinking like, what the hell did he just say? That sounded like Greek.
Right. No, I agree. And I think you got to pick one when it comes to it. And you know, maybe next week we'll get into some of if the end user agreement stuff, because it's different for all of them. It's going to be different for Apple if you put your content there. It's going to be different for Amazon Kindle, and you want to go, you know, you want to go with the, you know, the one you think is going to get you the most viewers and I would assume the most profit. So I could say right now, and as far as comic books, you know, I also read this week, Marvel's giving away free digital comics if you buy the Ultimates line. So if you buy the $3.99 Marvel book in the store, they're going to give you a code to go online and get, you know, the PDF or whatever their digital platform is. And Marvel's pushing it hard. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to see cover prices on the racks go up. And you're going to see digital just come into, and you know, into fruition full force. It happened with EGM magazine. For those of you guys that like video games, they tried to bring back their magazine this year and they couldn't do it. And it's all online now. And the cover price went up to like, you know, $7, $8, $9 for that. So that's kind of where, that's kind of just the tip of the iceberg with this stuff. I mean,
so
I don't know.
When you say like formats, I mean, is this like reading it off the cloud, or is this something I download and I get to keep on my device, or how does that work?
That's a good question. There's a great Wikipedia page. It's called wikipedia.org/wiki/comparison of ebook formats.
Yeah, I'll
and
put
there's
that
a,
link up.
That's a great chart, and it will tell you if you could put DRM on the files. And of course, DRM is synonymous with a lot of the Hollywood stuff. I believe Flixster, is it Flixster tried to do it with their, you know, movie sharing, thing, but DRM, yeah, will unlock or lock that file. If it goes through iTunes, you know, the iTunes comic book store, the iBook store, that's going to have the Apple DRM on it already. That's why you're running it through their software.
Uh-huh.
So, some of these places are going to add it. EPUB, as far as I know, is the most blue collar of these, meaning you could, anyone has really direct access to EPUB without signing on to another third party platform.
Huh. So, and just for anyone who doesn't know what DRM is, it's digital rights management. It's basically keeping your files sort of secure and safe from piracy, that sort of thing, or being able to copy them, correct?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, what do you guys think about, especially comics going the way of the dodo with paper? Will that happen? Or and do you guys think we're going to just see prices rise?
I they keep going up, man. I mean, it's ridiculous. I go to the comic shop and every couple of weeks, and it's not that I'm astounded by how much I'm spending, because I'm honestly not picking up that much stuff on a weekly basis. But I know that there's other guys that I review comics with or I see in the shop, and they're walking out with stacks and stacks of stuff. And I just think to myself, how can you afford that? I mean, I'm not poor, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. But I also know, like, I value my money to a certain extent. And I also, like, buying Blu-rays and DVDs and going to the movies and buying music. And how can you just pour all your money into that? I don't see it. The prices are not going to go down. I mean, I know that Marvel, this week they announced that they were going to do their cover stock on certain books, sort of format, I'm sorry, like the stock of the paper was on the covers was going to be the same as on the inside.
What?
Very much. Yeah. It was going to be comparable to the inside pages, and they were trying to keep the costs of the comic down to about $2.99 for certain books. And that seems like a great idea to me. But what I've never understood, especially with printed books, is why don't they just go back to the crappy newsprint, especially with the printing technology these days? You would think that it would save you publishing costs. But anytime you say that to publishers like Marvel or DC, they always say that that's not going to reduce the price of the comics, is going to crappier, you know, paper stock, which doesn't make sense to me, because if I go to a print shop and I have something printed up, I can tell you for damn sure that my costs go down if I use a crappier paper stock, you know.
That's true. Yeah.
So
I think I was just going to say, the question is also, and this is some of the things that we've discussed before with regards to special effects, which is, are the audiences that are reading these comics at a level of sophistication that when they publish to maybe an older stock, they feel the quality might not be there? So is there a trade-off in all of it?
Well, I mean, that was never a problem in the 70s. You know what I mean? Obviously, things have changed where now, and from what I understand, certain creators even demand that their books are printed on like the glossy, like very nice paper, because they want that sort of that cachet that comes with something that looks that nice. But the thing that people don't understand, and what digital might bring back to it if they drop their prices, is comic books up until a certain point were always junk culture. They were meant to be consumed and disposed and not collected, really. And they were never really respected as anything as they are today to a certain extent. And the only reason that they're respected today is because Hollywood knows that it can mine the properties for tons of money, and you can license out the characters for a ton of money. But nobody ever saw like the value in those characters back in the 70s and maybe 80s as much as the publishers themselves did. So before, it was just you would read a comic book and maybe toss it on the side. And I think part of it now is just wanting to maintain the collectability of the printed book. And to that, I say, screw it. I don't care about the collectability. I mean, I'm still going to put mine in bags and boards because that's what I do. You know, but if it's newsprint or if it's glossy, shiny stock, I'm still going to do it. So why not just go to crappy paper? Why not go to black and white? You know, which is what the Japanese do. You know, it's they keep their costs down by printing it on pulp, you know, newsprint paper, and they have these giant volumes, and the stories are printed in black and white, beautiful black and white artwork, which is going to reduce your costs. You know. I know a lot of colorists out there probably just had a heart attack when I said that, but you know, they would insert like special color pages, you know, every once in a while there would be these beautiful colored inserts and covers and stuff like that. And then there would be art magazines published for the comics. And so I just don't understand why American publishers are just so, I mean, do they honestly think that if we just went to black and white or back to newsprint, that every printed comic fan would just abandon ship? I mean, what do you guys think?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things. And I mean, what I'm hearing here is, and just to digress for a second, is that there's the advent of the digital side of things is changing everything, which is kind of back to the point of changing the experience. But Christian touched on a very good point, which is the fact that there's a whole side of collectability that gets called into question when you start talking about the digital. So it's,
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's kind of neat because the digital opens up the opportunity for people that are not Marvel, that are not DC, and can get their product out there. But it also, it impacts collectability and it impacts some other things.
I wonder if people will, you're going to get fans that download the books and then actually print them at home. I mean, that's an expensive venture though, but I could see people actually just doing that just to hang the stuff on the wall.
But are those printable files? I don't think that you're going to get some serious JPEG, you know, I mean, loss quality there, you know.
I don't know. I could see people just doing it, but maybe they're not print files. It depends what kind of printer you have, and it depends.
And if it's going straight to the iPad and straight to the Kindle, I mean, we know for a fact. I mean, I know from what I've heard that it's also a different reading experience, like Mark said earlier, which is
right.
It goes from panel to panel a lot of times instead of page to page, you know?
Sure. Sure. I mean, it's a totally different thing. I mean, it's going to be real easy, I think, to, you know, my buddy was telling me about magnet files last night. So a lot of the torrent sites are shut down, but now magnet sites are coming up, which I guess removes the torrent file, but it still behaves like a torrent. So I think you're still going to get a lot of people just, you know, Spider-Man, you know, whatever through whatever. You're going to get them passed around somehow.
Yeah.
And the collectability will change. It's somehow sad because, you know, I feel like the nostalgia factor of it is just leaving, and it's a different thing. So we're going to have all these newer people, I mean, guys like myself will be able to really get their work out there and at least share it with a lot of people. But yes, do you go to a convention with a thumb drive and say,
yeah,
I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right?
Right.
No, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. But that's the thing is I don't know if I see it as very much reverting back, at least the print books. You know, maybe print will just be people making their mini comics, you know, and it'll go back to sort of like junk culture again.
Right.
I don't know. For me, there's a lot of big flaws with the digital publishing format. And the biggest one, you know, because everyone says that, oh, you know, it's going to explode and everyone's going to have a digital reader. And I can tell you right now that the argument that people have against paper saying, oh, paper ruins the environment. If you put a digital reader like a Kindle in the hands of every man, woman, and child on the planet, that is a lot of raw material there, kids. That is a lot of damage being done to the environment. A lot of mining, a lot of rare minerals that go into those things. You know, the stuff that goes into our laptop. So I don't see it as being, you know, the end game. I don't see it unless somebody comes out with, you know, I don't know what movie it was where somebody had paper, a sheet of paper, and it was like basically the size, the width of an actual sheet of paper, and they were reading a magazine and it was just digitally flipping through it. Unless somebody comes actually invents that and can make it work with without raping the environment to the nth degree, I just don't see digital readers completely taking over. I just don't see it. It seems like an impossibility. Maybe it's just me.
Well, it does change the experience quite a bit. I mean, that's, I don't think there's any question with that. But the other thing too is, does this also contribute to the possibility of comic piracy? I mean, I don't know if that's something that's currently an issue, but when you switch to a predominantly digital format on things, you know, you always run the risk, and the specter is always out there of, well, okay, now there's comics that are out there that may not be the real thing. And that impacts collectability as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's piracy all over. And I know that DC apparently was hoping that piracy would be reduced because they are embracing digital in a huge way. You know, when they did the new 52 and all that, that was part of their big thing was, you know, that we are going to do this all digital and it's going to be day and date. The same day that you went to the store, that it would be available digitally. And whenever I've talked to comic book stores, they don't seem to be worried about the digital formatting. You know, they don't seem to be concerned. But I haven't seen any data as far as how the sales are on digital. From what I understand, print is still outselling digital.
Sure.
You know, and maybe because they haven't gotten the word out that these things are available, or they're not making them readily available to children. But, you know, to have that digital experience, you have to have a reader, you know, and they are expensive. They're not cheap. I mean, the Kindle is the cheapest and it's $200, right?
I think you can get one for $100.
Not the color one. I mean, maybe.
Oh, really?
Used. Yeah, no. A Kindle, a black and white Kindle is probably around $100, which is what my wife has. And then I was going to get her for her birthday the newest one, and I ended up getting her something else because she wanted something else. But that one's like $200.
That's interesting because that brings up another point, which is, are you tied to a certain platform to read certain books? And the nice thing about getting a book off the rack is you choose if you're going to read it in your bathroom or your living room. And you know, there's so much about the digital stuff to me that just complicates the matter.
And
I think this is one of the things where the music industry was dragged kicking and screaming into this whole world. The publishing world seems to just be, they could kind of see the writing on the wall, and I think you have more, you know, more formats and more adoption, but there is really no clear leader here. I mean, if you have to buy three different readers to read three different publisher stuff, It's just kind of wacky right now. Well, I think the whole thing's wacky.
The whole thing is wacky. And one of the big things that's very wacky about it is, you know, when DC was doing the new DC 52 and they announced that they were going to start, you know, publishing digitally and the Amazon Kindle came out, there were a bunch of Kindle books that DC Comics that were only going to be exclusive to the Kindle upon their digital publication. And Barnes & Noble freaked out and started pulling those graphic novels from their shelves in the shops. Because they were like, you can't just, you know, give it to Amazon and not let the Nook have it, or, you know, the iPad have it. So they started pulling stuff from the shelves and they fought back, and DC reacted and made the exclusivity only like for a certain period of time, like something like 30 days on after the initial launch. And I think they've stopped doing that now. I think they're available to all the formats, but I don't know. It seems like a mess. And right now I'm still reading print. I have a laptop PC, but I only use that right now for reading PDF review files that I get every once in a while, you know, because every once in a while somebody, an independent creator, wants to get their thing read and asks for a review, and they send a PDF, which is good because it saves them money. And then I can just flip my screen around and read it on that, you know, which is a pretty good experience. But my laptop tablet is a little bulky. It's not as slim as, say, you know, the iPad or the Kindle. So I don't know. There's a lot of stuff coming down the pike. It's going to be interesting to see how it all changes.
Well, there's also, I mean, it's interesting too, because it sounds like with the introduction, or, you know, into the digital environment, that there's kind of a thing going on that's similar to what happened to video and audio when it was first introduced into the web space. You had all these different competing formats, and then it eventually kind of congealed into a flash video type format, but now they're moving back away. You know, they're coming kind of full circle with that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I mean, I think for somebody who's creating their own comic and trying to get it out there, having to do three times the work and move it into three different mediums is kind of ridiculous. I mean, it's work intensive.
Yeah.
And it may, it the same format that kind of invites the independent comic creator also may limit them from a work perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's like the format of comics works because it's the guy draws it, the guy writes it, inks it, the publisher publishes it. It goes on the shelf, which is a worldwide distribution method that works because you pick the comic off the shelf, you pay for it, and you're done.
Yeah.
Well, now there's a bunch of e-readers in the middle of you and the shelf.
Yeah.
And now you've got to pay to take that. You got to pay more just to actually get to the shelf.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know? You've got to pay the $200 or
right.
whatever to buy the thing. And then,
right. It's,
you know,
bullshit.
Yeah,
it's bullshit. I'm cursing on the podcast, but.
That's fine. That's
I
what
guess
it's
I'm
there
glad,
for.
Yeah, I'm glad. Thank you. That is why it's there. But it, to me, it's bullshit. And I could say I'll be monitoring this a lot just because. As I get my book ready to go, and right now I can see doing half print and, you know, having a print run so you can sign those and give them out or sell them, and then having you can't not have the e-book at this point. I think if you're going to put something out, you've got to put it out for people. So,
well, I think the thing right now is, you know, just web comics, like kind of what I'm starting to dip into, and a lot of people are finding a lot of success just doing a webcomic, you know. I don't know how that translates to e-readers. I don't know, like, how the big webcomics like PvP and you know, other comics like that are translating over to the iPad and stuff like that. But I mean, just getting your stuff out there, you know, like Baby Badass, it's just get your webcomic out there on the web first and see how it goes from there, because that's how a lot of people are reading their web comics. And it's, I can tell you right now, it's easy, it's cheap, And, you know, there's a book, How to Make Web Comics, by one of them being the author of PvP, Scott Kurtz. And it's a great book. I mean, it's, but now with these e-readers, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how it's all going to change. It sounds like crazy talk, but we'll obviously be keeping our eyes on it because we're fans, and you know, we're going to see how the future changes, which it sounds like in the next 10 years, the change is going to be radical. I don't know if comic book shops are going to be around the way they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that the other thing too, is it calls to a certain level of nostalgia, and I don't mean to get all old fashioned, but the fact of the matter is that, I mean, it still makes us reminiscent of the days when you read a comic that you really enjoyed and you handed it off to your friend and said, hey, take a look at this. And I mean,
yeah,
the web comic medium, you can still do that. But with the ebook reader, I think there's a little bit less of that going on.
Well, I don't know. Is there? Because you can go online with an e-reader and say, hey, I just picked this, you know, you can tweet, you can Facebook or whatever, or Google Plus, and you could say, hey, I just read this. And then if you have a bunch of followers or people that you're friends with, you know, quote unquote friends, you know, then you've got 200 people that just saw your tweet, you know, or your Facebook post. And then they're like, oh, maybe I should check that out. So as opposed to me just having one print copy and handing it off to you, now I just said, hey, everybody, check this out. Of course, they would have to pay for it to check it out if it's something like Marvel or DC, but right, that's still word of mouth. And then you tell two friends, and then they tell two friends, and then
and
they
so
tell
on two and so on and so on.
But anyway, all right, we've talked a lot about this, and we have other subjects to move on to. And speaking of change, I know that Mark wanted to talk about the found format type of thing that's showing up in filmmaking these days. So maybe we should move on to that so that we don't end up just moving in circles with the digital publishing, because we could talk about that for days.
Maybe we should.
Let's move on.
Well,
let's
that's why on. We have other podcasts.
Okay, so... The found footage it generally refers to, and I guess a lot of people, I think, kind of they see the beginnings of this in a little film called The Blair Witch Project, which came out, God, in 1999. But I was surprised to find that there were quite a few films that came out before it as early as 1980 that that used this kind of storytelling format. And essentially what it is that it's being told through the perspective of one or more characters that are in the film, traditionally through a video camera, kind of a documentary feel. And there's just been a tremendous amount of usage and kind of proliferation of this format in the past couple of years. I was really surprised when looking around at information, seeing exactly how many films out there have actually utilized this format. So I think the beginning was the recognized beginning is with the Blair Witch Project, and it was essentially reintroduced in a larger perspective with Cloverfield, and then with more recently the Paranormal Activity movies. This year in particular are a tremendous amount of films that are coming out that have that are using this format, and it's even found its way into television now.
Yeah, yeah. You were saying, what's that show, The River?
Yeah, yeah. The River is a new show that's out there, and they use it, which I think is interesting because the use of this format, I think, is adept at telling a cinematic story. Over an hour and a half or 2 hours. And I think this kind of looks at some of the challenges of whether or not this format can be used in a prolonged kind of experience like a weekly television show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how does that, I mean, you said you saw some episodes of that, and I find it very interesting. How would that translate, like going week to week? Does somebody just find a new videotape every week and pop it in or something? Or like, how does that work? Like with The River?
The perspective that they do with this show is, I think, very similar to how they handled Blair Witch and how they handled Cloverfield, which is the idea is that this kind of cache of documentary footage was found after these people, disposition unknown type thing.
Yeah.
So we're seeing kind of stuff that's already happened, but it's being rolled out in kind of a real-time documentary format.
And it's got to be one long-ass documentary, because you want a TV show to go on for like 5 seasons, correct?
Well, I think the perspective would be that. But the interesting part about it is that I think if you look at Blair Witch, and if, I know we were talking about this kind of offline with the with Rec and some of the films that, that came in between the kind of the recognized American milestones, is that a lot of those were told from the single perspective of the cameraman that was kind of, or camera woman, whatever, that, you know, is kind of documenting all this, which is interesting because it, it does lend a certain level of believability. I know in Cloverfield, you know, that film is something that is unique because you're seeing all these kind of, these kind of amazing events happening through the perspective of the people that it's actually happening to. And it puts people and it puts the audience into the film.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know the problem that I had with Cloverfield. We discussed it when we saw it, is that you really have to go with the possibility, or you have to follow the belief system that no matter what awful things happen to this guy and his friends, he's not going to drop that camera no matter the fuck what. He's just going to keep going, where you would have dropped that camera a long time ago. I would have dropped that camera as soon as a building blew. I would have been running my ass off, crapping myself through the streets. There's no way that you would keep a video camera running. I just, that, and that's part of my problem with a bit of the found footage format and why Chronicle did such a good job of it, because you know,
don't give it away. There's, not, there's actually something of a spoiler that, that's in that movie. That
no, I'm not giving it away. I'm just saying that the security cameras and splicing that stuff in there. You know, we're using different sources of video, which is what I said. Like after Cloverfield, which to me a more interesting thing is you know Cloverfield starts off with a bunch of rich kids at a party. You know, people that I'm not really that interested in. But what if somebody drops the camera, you know, in the middle of some craziness that's going on, and then you get like a New York City cab driver picking it up and being like, wow, I found this. Oh my gosh, aliens are invading or whatever. And then he drops it and a cop picks it up, you know, and so you would get different perspectives from different parts of the island. You know what I mean? And maybe stretch the alien invasion out over a week or, you know what I mean? Because it just, I have a really hard time believing that one person, unless he was a documentary filmmaker crew, you know, was going to keep that camera rolling no matter what was happening. I mean, I remember in Cloverfield, they're going through the subway tunnels and a girl gets attacked by one of the aliens or something, and the dude is still holding on to the camera. No, I think he actually hits the thing with his camera a couple of times. I'm like, no. Sorry, guys. If I have a video camera and one of you guys is getting attacked by an alien, I'm going to drop my video camera and help you. I know it's the wrong thing to do, but I'm going to drop it and help you guys. That's just me. It's just me. It's the kind of guy I am.
Well, I think this it touches upon an interesting thing that they kind of introduced this. Well, not introduced, but I mean, with Rec, we saw them using kind of a documentary footage. So the construct of the film, it's believable that these people are,
absolutely.
You know, they're recording this and it's, there's a reason for them doing it. And there's a reason this guy won't put the camera down. When you get into Paranormal Activity 2, this translates a little bit into to what they do on the river, is that there are multiple sources of video. And and at least in Paranormal Activity 2, the premise is that somebody's broken into the home and they put in a security camera system.
Oh, cool. That's
so good. That there is a more passive kind of there's a passive agent going on, seeing, you know, what's going on in this film. And that's the way they handle with the river. It's kind of an interplay of both of the best of both formats, is that it's handheld as well as there are cameras placed, you know, in kind of these omniscient positions that'll allow, you know, for better storytelling.
Yeah. Well, Ian, what do you think of like the whole found footage thing? You've been kind of quiet over there.
Oh no, this is good. I like it. I like it, especially when it's done like Chronicle did it. Blair Witch actually, a lot of it makes me nauseous.
I hate Blair Witch.
when Blair Witch came out, I actually spent most of the movie looking at the wall I was sitting by because I was getting motion sickness. And I really thought, I really think a lot of the time it's a cop out. Cloverfield, I couldn't stand. I thought it was awful for many reasons besides the whole, points that we already mentioned. I thought Chronicle did the best with it that I think I've seen so far. I mean, there's other directors, especially like Michael Mann, who did Heat and who did, the Miami Vice reboot and Collateral. He likes to mix his formats, and although his storytelling is still pretty linear. And I usually like if there's some texture in there. Usually, though, 99% of the time, Chronicle's an exception. I'm usually getting sick during these films. I can't watch. Yeah, I can't watch Paranormal Activity either. Because that's horror. I can't watch like horror like that.
What is it about that you don't like horror in general, or do you just?
Yeah, I don't like really horror in general. I like monster movies, and I like sci-fi stuff. But yeah, if it's a horror movie, you probably won't catch me there. So a horror movie plus found footage equals like, it's like country music.
Oh, come on now. I like country and I love horror. So
all right, some countries, all right. But listen, I love Chronicle. I thought they just did such a great job with it. And I find you have to forgive. There's a certain amount of forgiveness you have to say. Like, okay, this is the way it's going to be done. And if you're cool with it, you could do it. I mean, I saw about 20 people walk out of the Chronicle show.
No way. Really?
That I was in. Now, that could have been for other religious reasons, because there was definitely a Jewish youth group there. And I don't know if the rabbi approved of it. But I did see quite a few people walk out of that show. And I'm like, it could be because of just the way it's shot. But yeah, I think it's a good point, and it's a good topic to talk about, because there's just it's definitely a trend, and it's definitely picking up. You guys think there's just going to be a certain amount of movies like this per year? We're just going to keep seeing this?
Oh yeah, I'm sure, because they're cheap to make. I mean, that's the whole thing, right? They're very cheap to make. They're you can use digital footage. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing too is the fact that there's another facet to this, and I think it's not a surprise that you see this kind of genre plays very closely with kind of with either horror films or science fiction films. I think this particular format allows a greater sense of believability to storylines that may seem completely out there. It adds a little bit more of a shock value that this is a documentary. Oh, this really happened. Not to suggest that there's people out there that believe these things really happened, but even if you go into it, I think the suspension of disbelief is a little bit less when you're talking about some of these found footage formats, because the expectation is there. It's granular. There's kind of a merger between the real world and what could be, and so you're seeing it through that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that, I buy more into it when it's a fake documentary sort of thing. You know what I mean? And you mentioned some of the earlier movies that have, from like the 80s. I mean, I think the first one on that Wikipedia list that I found was Cannibal Holocaust, which is considered one of the most awful horror. Wow. Like, not just awful, it's awful in the fact that I think when it was first released, a lot of people thought there was a lot of real stuff going on there, like animals being killed and stuff like that. And basically, people were freaking out about that. And I've actually seen that in the theater. I saw it at the New Beverly on one of the Grindhouse nights. And, and I've seen it... I saw it on video too a long time ago, and it's a pretty abhorrent movie. But the one that I really love that blew my mind is a French film called Man Bites Dog.
Oh, that's a classic. That's a classic.
Awesome. And not for the soft at heart either. But
like that one.
Oh, I love
it. I like that
one. I think it's great. And if you've seen the unedited version, the really, really awful version, oh my God, it's just wrong. It's so wrong.
That's a film that is very popular in film school. They showed that to us in film history.
Yeah.
It's one of the first films. And, you know those guys got kicked out of school for making that, right?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, wow. The guys, they got totally reamed for that. And that really is one of the first kind of films that does that. I find it very playful, though. I find it, of course, very dark but it doesn't have the... To me, it doesn't have the kind of horrific elements that some of the newer stuff does, but it's so brilliant, that movie.
It's awesome.
So brilliant. That's funny. I haven't heard that movie mentioned in a while. And yeah, they made us watch that one. They sat us down right after we watched like D.W. Griffith's, you guys know that movie? Yeah, like right after Birth of a Nation, like the next class was.
Let's watch like an amazing double feature.
Yeah, exactly.
Just wrong.
Exactly.
Wrong in every way.
There you go.
Ku Klux Klan meets the French hitman who likes to rape old ladies. Yeah, that's great.
It sounds like a new movie, actually. You just created there.
Yeah, a new genre. But yeah, I mean, I love the found footage format. I only hate it when it's done very badly. So,
I think that can probably be said of any format too. Yeah, I mean, it works well when it's executed properly, and it's interesting. You know, did the two of you feel that this format is something that is starting to get overexposed? That some of the notoriety is going to be out of it because, I mean, there was Blair Witch, and while there's a lot of films that were made in between, there seems to be kind of this chasm between Blair Witch and then Cloverfield and Paranormal Activity, which kind of relaunched this kind of format into for modern audiences. Is it being used too much now?
That's a good question.
I don't know. I mean, it's not like every movie being made is being done this way, you know. I do have a friend who sort of bemoans the advent of digital filmmaking because he says a lot of the craft has been taken out of cinematography and stuff like that. And, that it's just too easy for people who are unskilled.
That's true.
You know, to be able to pick up a camera and, you know, make a competent film. But you can also see it happening in the studio pictures that unless it's a Transformers movie or a superhero movie, you're losing the epic quality of filmmaking. You're really not seeing like Lawrence of Arabia or Out of Africa or, Chariots of Fire. You're not seeing, or Gandhi, like this quality of sort of widescreen filmmaking being embraced anymore, you know, and especially by the studios, you know, who choose to just use it on, say, something like The Avengers that, you know, they're reserving it for that. So, I mean, I don't think there's too much of it, but I think that the digital filmmaking, you know, world has definitely affected the way movies are being made. Not just the found footage format, you know?
Well, I think there's also an interesting kind of connection that can be drawn, which is the fact that for a long period of time, and it's still semi-present, but these kinds of things almost kind of achieve this kind of natural equilibrium. We went from a period, and the best connection I can draw is in television. There were these kinds of huge, very expensive shows that were very epic in their quality. And I'm thinking of the John Wells shows that were on NBC for a long time, you know, your ERs and your West Wings and all that. And then juxtaposed a lot of kind of reality television. And then in filmmaking, there seems to be a lot of that too. There were these kind of huge movies that are being made. And then there's a lot of the kind of found footage genre coming around right now. And then I think juxtapose that you do have these kind of epic films that are coming out like The Dark Knight, like The Avengers. So maybe it makes those films a little bit more special. I don't know. I guess if you talk to different people, there'd be different opinions.
Yeah, I think you're going to get a lot of people that see something like Chronicle and are like, great. let's hire this director. Like, actually, I read on Rotten Tomatoes, the director of Chronicle has been in talks to do the Venom movie. From Spider-Man. So, you know, for some directors, it's going to be great, but I guess that goes back to the quality of the work. And then there's going to be studios that are just like, let's do a found footage movie. And they're going to pick up any piece of crap that's been sitting on their shelf for, you know, 50 years and be like, we got this thing, and, you know, and you're going to get some crap. And that, I think that's what happens with trends across the board. But
Money talks, you know. I mean, Paranormal Activity made a ton of money. The Blair Witch Project made a ton of money for the studios that released them. So, of course, you're going to see more of this.
Because,
you know, you can just grab a bunch of no-name actors, you know, and put them in your movie, or people that haven't blown up yet. And that's with found footage. That's probably more of what you want anyway, because you don't want somebody going like, hey, that's Tom Cruise running away from a goblin in the woods. You know, I don't believe that he's real because he's Tom Cruise. You know, it's just, you know, so you want unknowns. You want, so it gets you to get your bottom line down. So you're going to see a lot of them, you know, and the technology, the digital filmmaking technology is getting better so that, I mean, you saw it in Chronicle where he started off with the older camera, and then as the movie went on, he got a better camera, and the quality was perfect. You just, I was sitting there thinking, oh, wow, this looks great, you know, so.
Well, I think there's also this kind of breaking down of the barrier that this kind of artificial barrier that's put in place to kind of shield the audience from what's going on in the movie. So when you employ this kind of genre and the no-name actors and the documentary style of things, there is that kind of, you know, it moves the audience maybe one step closer. Now, whether that's where they want to be or whether that's where they should be is a argument for a different day. But I think it'll be interesting to see how this translates over to the television medium. I think it'll be the strength or weakness of this format as it's applied to something that runs over several weeks or months or even years, as opposed to just an hour and a half, I think will either define or redefine how well this genre can be utilized.
So how is The River doing? Do you know?
I don't. I haven't seen it, seen how it's doing in the ratings, but it's interesting. I mean, the storyline, it's very simple. So it actually plays very well to what's going on around it. The documentary style works very, very well. And I think a lot of times with this kind of storyline, you see what you would with a lot of the other horror movies out there. It's that you can get away with kind of the old school horror mentality, which is that there are things going on off screen that are terrifying. Think that it does force a little bit of creativity from the standpoint that you have to be very, very kind of targeted in how you frighten your audience. It's not, you can't have a lot of kind of, there can't be a lot of, you know, highly visual things going on, because a lot of times the most horrific kinds of things are going on off screen.
Yeah. Which is, you know, that's just the number one rule in horror movies, you know, don't show everything, you know,
right.
Unless you show, the more you can freak people out. So,
right. Yeah. And I think Chronicle is something that I think what they introduce into the movie is something that will have to be looked at for future. And I think some of the innovations that they introduce in how they shoot it, I think it may give some greater flexibility to the format. If you guys get a chance, check out a really small, small from the standpoint that not a lot of people saw it, but I don't know if you've seen it. Check out Catfish.
I don't say anything about it because I keep hearing great things about that movie and I don't want to see it. So
it's both. It's a combination of the documentary and the found footage genre. Give it a whirl. It's a simple story, but it is interesting. I don't want to say too much about it.
I think it's streaming on Netflix right now. But what was I was going to say something about Chronicle? Oh yeah, they apparently just announced that they're going forward with a sequel. So, yeah, and Max Landis, the guy who wrote the first one, who is John Landis' son, he's going to write the sequel. So that's great. I am excited to see that because I'd go see a sequel to Chronicle. I thought it was, you know, there's a lot of things that you could explore, like how did they get their powers and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And mm-hmm. I thought it was good. I liked it. You know, and just because the guy seemed like he was dead, who knows what kind of alien, you know, technology or radiation, you know. Dead is never dead in comic books, right?
Or the movies or anything else for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. So he could come back. I could see like some reasoning of, you know, whatever it is that gave him their powers, made him immortal or something like that. You know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's, yeah, but I think found footage is here to stay at least for a while, and it'll fade out again, and then there'll be something else like Paranormal Activity that'll make a bajillion dollars, and you know, then it'll be back. So we're approaching the hour point, and in any case, I just wanted to drop some quick love on the new DC Nation block on Cartoon Network. They started a Green Lantern CGI animated series, and they started re-airing new episodes of a show called Young Justice, which is sort of a takeoff on the Teen Titans a little bit. But both are great shows, and I just wanted to sneak in a couple of words about them. I actually was a little hesitant to check out the CGI Green Lantern. And you can tell that they're doing it because of Clone Wars success. But, you know, it's a good show for kids. I'm not going to say it doesn't seem to have the gritty quality that Clone Wars does. But who knows? It just started. But I think they did a decent job. I was very surprised. And apparently they're going to do a Batman one next year. So it's sort of like a CGI animated Batman thing. And the great thing about DC Nation on Cartoon Network is that they tend to do like little experimental shorts with other superheroes. So they did a Plastic Man one, and they brought back some of the Teen Titans from the other cartoons, and they did like a Super Baby thing this past weekend. It's a lot of fun. I would recommend checking it out. So if you're a DC fan or a comic book fan, which anybody who is probably already watching them anyway, so my recommendation doesn't count for shit. But what are you going to do? But anyway, this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for listening to us ramble on. I am Christian Horn, and you are?
Mark Altman.
And Ian Schiller.
And we will hopefully see you next week. Next weekend is WonderCon, so we're going to have to figure out a different time to record, but hopefully we will be here. All right. See you next week. Ciao!
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Christian.
Mark.